Yep. Calling to order this meeting of the Commerce Committee. We do have a quorum. Our first item of business is approval of our minutes from February 19th, 2024. Representative Cagle, would you like to make a motion?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cagle moves approval of the minutes from February 19th, 2024. Discussion to the motion. Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes from February 19th, 2024 are approved. The first item on our agenda today is House File 2309 from Representative Elkins. Welcome back to the Commerce Committee, Representative Elkins. I will move House File 2309 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And we should probably take your DE1 amendment first.
Mr. Chair. So the DE1 amendment, I had the amendment posted in two forms so people could see, you know, what are the individual changes that I'd like to move the DE amendment, which incorporates and basically engrosses all of those individual amendments into a new version of the bill.
All right. Mm-hmm. So I will move the DE1 amendment, which gets the bill into the shape that Representative Elkins would like the committee to consider it. Any discussion to the DE1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the DE1 is adopted. Representative Elkins, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is a comprehensive consumer data privacy protection bill that would establish a new chapter in state law which will govern the privacy of data that's in private hands as opposed to the Data Practices Act, which governs data in government hands. Comprehensive consumer data privacy laws like this one have now passed in 13 states around the country. And like the bills that have passed in a dozen of those states, it's based on the Washington Privacy Act template. Eight states passed such a bill in 2023 alone, four of them red, four of them blue. Texas passed its bill, a version of the bill, unanimously with GOP authorship. Most 2023 bills, including this one, are based upon the Connecticut and Colorado versions of the bill that passed in 2023. So you've probably noticed as you're doing your own, managing your own online accounts, that you'll see notices to the effect of, if you live in one of these states, you may have additional privacy rights. So what this bill would essentially do is give Minnesota residents the same rights enjoyed by residents of other states that have passed bills like this one. The rights that are granted by the bill are described in Section 6. Consumers have the right to have companies tell them what kinds of personal data they have about them, correct inaccurate data, delete personal data about them, provide a copy of their personal data upon request, and to opt out of having their personal data sold, used in targeted advertising, or used to profile them. And if their data is used for profiling, my version of the bill gives consumers the right to question the decisions that result from the profiling, the reasons why the profiling resulted in the decision that it did, and question the accuracy of the data used to profile them, and request the correction of inaccuracies in the data used to profile them and have the profiling rerun. So profiling is a term, basically sometimes as you use automated decision making is another term that's used, but it's basically things like your credit report. And so the bill gives you rights similar to those you would have under the Fair Credit Reporting Act and extends it to other areas where decisions that affect your life will be made. So there are responsibilities of the company described in Section 8, which provide, require very clear and prominent privacy notices and restrict controllers to only collecting the data that they need to conduct business with you and nothing more. Requires controllers, which are the companies that hold the data, to secure and protect the consumer's data, prevents the processing of sensitive data without the consumer's consent, and requires controllers to provide a mechanism for the consumers to revoke their consent and exercise the rights under the bill. So Section 3 is the definition section. This definitions are broken down into role players, such as consumers, which is you and me, controllers, companies that produce the data, processors, or companies that process data on their behalf. It predicts categories of data such as personal data, sensitive personal data, which is personal data specifically about things like race, ethnicity, biometric or genetic data, data about children, or specific geolocation data, which in my bill is data that's accurate enough to determine your address. And it constricts, defines things that can be done with the data, such as profiling, which is automated decision making, sale, and what constitutes targeted advertising. A great deal of time in developing the bill was devoted to the exclusion section, Section 4. If your company is already covered by a federal law like HIPAA or the Fair Credit Reporting Act or Grimm-Leach-Bliley, those laws will govern instead of this one. A lot of discussion about those. The bill also prohibits companies from taking data which is collected pseudonymously, anonymously, and re-identifying it for you. And there's an assessment section that requires on an annual basis that a company create an assessment document that discusses how the measures that they're taking to comply with the law. So, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that. We will now move to testimony. We have a few people who signed up in advance to testify, starting with Bruce Newstead. Mr. Newstead, come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome back to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Newstead. I'm president of the Minnesota Retailers Association. We're a collection of about 1,200 storefronts, innovative retailers across the state, representing all the different business models that you see in retail today, from Main Street onto national brands. I just want to say I appreciate the opportunity to talk and represent Elkins' consumer data privacy bill today. He didn't say it, so I'll say it for him. This is a big day for Representative Elkins. He really has been working with folks for years on this bill, and we appreciate the conversations that we've had over the years. I can attest that the work that Representative Elkins done on this has been thorough. I don't think we always agree on everything in the bill, but it's been a thorough conversation. And we hope in the end what we end up with is a bill that works for consumers, it works for retailers, and it works for other interested parties as well. I will say over the course of the conversations with Representative Elkins, we've always said we wish retailers weren't caught up in his bill. We really think the intended audience of this bill is data processors and data brokers. But having said that, the bill that you have in front of you today does seem to align largely Minnesota's approach to consumer data privacy to what other states have done, including several that Representative Elkins has mentioned, Connecticut, Colorado, et cetera. That alignment is actually super important to retailers and even more so important to the vendors that serve those retailers. I do want to mention one area of the bill real quick that we may be deviating from other states, and that's the area where there's a definition of geolocation. And while we're still kind of looking at Representative Elkins' new definitions of that, we hope to be able to provide the author with some feedback on that going forward. And frankly, a few other spots in the bill as we kind of get more narrowed in on the language, you start to notice the particularities. And so we look forward to continuing those conversations on five or six areas that we think could be better in the bill or more aligned with other states. And finally, I just want to flag, I know, Mr. Chair, it's outside your jurisdiction, but I do want to flag that we think the current enforcement mechanism in this bill really affects the best approach for clarity for consumers and retailers going forward. So, Mr. Chair, thanks for the time today. And again, thanks to Representative Elkins for work and dialogue in this bill. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Chris Weiland. Just come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Weiland. I'm the chair of Restore the Fourth Minnesota, a grassroots privacy and anti-surveillance activist group. While we applaud the effort that has gone into this bill, and we really appreciate the aims of it, and we think it's important as it is currently written, I don't think that we can support it. It does not go nearly far enough to protect the privacy of Minnesotans, and in a couple of different ways, but primarily you should all be immediately suspicious of the fact that the person that the lobbyist represents all of the retail organizations is supportive of the way that this bill does enforcement. It gives no additional funding. It gives all the enforcement mechanisms up to the AG, and it gives no additional funding for him to pursue it. It doesn't create a private right of action. It's just not, it doesn't have any teeth. Companies probably won't like the idea of being chewed up by a mouth that doesn't have any teeth in it, but they'll escape the process unharmed. The bill needs to have teeth. It needs to have a mechanism to actually deter companies from doing these kind of things. As an organization, we're primarily focused on abuses of government, the way in which government can abuse surveillance powers. But as a technologist, there isn't really a way to, if data is worse than money when it comes to seeping through regulatory cracks. If you don't cut it off at the source, it's going to slosh back and forth between government and private sector in ways that you can't really predict. And this bill does not cut off collection at the source. It doesn't have what the GDPR has in the sense so that it doesn't create data minimization requirements. It doesn't force companies to limit data collection to the data that's strictly necessary to do the business that they want to do. So this bill is incredibly important, but as it's currently written, I don't think that we can support it. Representative Elkins has been really good about being responsive to feedback, and we look forward to continuing to working with them. And he's been good with working with Consumer Reports and with the EFF and other civil rights and privacy activist orgs, and we'll keep trying to make the bill better. But this bill is part of a national conversation on the importance of privacy. And if Minnesota passes a Milliput-Toast regulation, it is going to encourage the federal government and encourage other states to pass Milliput-Toast regulation that doesn't go nearly far enough to protect people's privacy. I would encourage folks to continue to work on this bill and to continue to pass for truly strong and robust privacy regulations. No one wants to live in a dystopian world where everybody feels like they're being surveilled 24/7 by the government and by corporations. But this bill wouldn't achieve that objective. It would paper over a system that largely already exists.
Thank you for your testimony, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name, Mr. Wayland.
Yeah, that's fine.
Our next testifier is Tyler Deers. Mr. Deers.
Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson, members of the committee. Tyler Deers, serve as the Midwest Executive Director for TechNet. I'm going to pile on here and want to also thank Representative Elkins for his work on this bill. I know he's done yeoman's work on the issue going all the way back to, I think, 4 years.
Yeah, 2019.
When I first actually joined TechNet. So we've been involved in it every step of the way. And I know that since then, the state data privacy landscape has evolved a lot since then. As Representative Elkins had mentioned, this proposal is based off the Washington Privacy Act, which ironically is actually not passed it yet, which I think shows the complexities of legislation like this. But since then, 13 or 14 states have now passed legislation largely built on the framework. And as the representative mentioned, the bill gives consumers new rights that are currently not afforded to them. And the industry is generally supportive of these types of proposals passing so long as they're interoperable. That's a very key provision with existing state privacy frameworks. There are some provisions of this bill that do differ from other state privacy laws. Look, I know Minnesota has a long tradition of being unique and especially in privacy laws, and we respect that. But you know, the internet knows no boundaries, and it is intrastate by its very nature. And so, where possible, we do strive for that interoperability. Again, we believe that new privacy laws should be based upon an interoperable, uniform set of standards to avoid imposing any type of patchwork of policies across jurisdictions. And so, that to the extent that this final product does contain any outlier provisions not found in other state laws, you know, we need some more time and thought to better digest these new provisions and continue to work with Representative Elkins. But again, we appreciate his willingness to continue to work on it through its next committee stop. And we do sincerely appreciate his thoughtful and collaborative approach to crafting this bill. And has clearly done his homework and has really been seen as a thought leader on this issue across the country. You'll see him at any NCSL privacy roundtables or anything. So he shows up and does the homework and so with that, we look forward to continuing to work with them as this bill moves throughout the process and look forward to getting it done. Thanks.
Thank you. That concludes the list of people who signed up to testify. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. Seeing none, Representative Niska, just under the wire there.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, and thank you, Representative Elkins. I echo some of the comments about the work that you've done to try to bring in stakeholders and really try to hone in the right enforcement mechanism. I just wanted, we've heard a lot about exceptions and who isn't covered by it. I was just hoping you could give a little bit of a description about what are the companies that are regulated by this bill. And what are the specific, you know, give us kind of some real world examples of what protections this bill is actually giving Minnesotans against kind of specific content.
Sure.
Example.
Yeah, I didn't go into specifics on the exclusion section, Mr. Chair. But as a general rule, companies that are already governed by comprehensive federal laws like HIPAA or Gramm-Leach-Bliley Fair Credit Reporting Act will continue to be governed under those laws as well. I would say that I probably spent more time, negotiating over the reach of the Gramm-Leach-Bliley exemption than any other provision of the bill. And many states, a blanket exemption was granted to any company, and in some cases even affiliates of companies that are even touched by Gramm-Leach-Bliley. I've talked to the authors of some of those bills, and they've all told me that that was their biggest regret. One of them used the example of Rocket Holdings. So Rocket Mortgage, Rocket Holdings owns Rocket Mortgage, which is a mortgage company which would be covered under Gramm-Leach-Bliley. But they also own CoreLogic, which was one of the largest online advertising companies in the country. And now that the bill that grants GLBA exemptions to anyone affiliated with a financial company, they're asserting that because they're part of a financial holding company, that CoreLogic is exempt from this bill. And so the approach that I've taken on that particular approach is the one that that is used in Oregon. In Oregon, the bill equivalent bill was actually developed by the Attorney General's office, and they saw that loophole and said, "We're not going for this." And so what they've done, that they did, is said, "Okay, if you're a regulated bank company and also subject to state banking laws, or a regulated insurance company also regulated with an overlay of state insurance laws, then you're covered, but not your affiliates." And so I developed language along those lines, which has been accepted by both the bankers and the insurers. And so I found a way in this case to kind of thread the line to provide the appropriate level of protection. And the other change I made, I picked up from Texas. It is the small business definition of a small business. So small businesses, as defined by the Small Business Administration, are also exempt. And there's a letter in the file from the National Federation of Independent Businesses endorsing the bill, because I included that Texas provision in it.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Thank you, Representative Elkins. Again, I just appreciate the obviously we're very concerned, and we all should be concerned about protecting Minnesotans as much as possible, but I appreciate the way that you've balanced trying to make it as consistent as possible for multi-state businesses and trying to carve out businesses that are regulated otherwise or are small businesses. So I appreciate the way that the approach you've taken on this.
Great. Thank you, Representative Niska.
Mm-hmm. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Elkins. Looking at this bill and also looking at the exclusions, would you care to expound a little bit maybe for our general understanding as to the reasons for the exclusions around government entities as it relates to your bill?
Mr. Chair, so the government entities in Minnesota are governed by the Data Practices Act.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you.
Closing comments, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to respond to a couple of the comments that were made here. First of all, one of the things that I did add onto the bill in the assessment section is language that does require companies to describe their policies related to data minimization, data retention. It requires companies to designate a chief privacy officer and their compliance department to make sure that the provisions in the bill are complied with. And I've been in ongoing discussions with the Attorney General's office about the enforcement. They're confident in their ability to do so. They have already been comparing notes with their counterparts in other states that have already implemented these bills. And there is a fiscal note to give them additional resources.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. I will renew my motion that House File 2309, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 2309, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Thank you, Representative Elkins. The next item. We're going to go a little bit out of order today. The next bill on our agenda is House File 3868 from Representative Perrin. While you are making your way up to the dais. I will move House File 3868 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Representative Curran, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair. I'll just a brief introduction here, and then I'll turn it over to some experts. So what we have before us today, HF 3868, is pretty simple, but I know it's a really thick and complex bill. But really what it's doing is just getting Minnesota in conformity with 20-plus other states across the country, specifically having to do with emerging technology, so making sure that we are up to date and able to use the most current technology when it comes to things like banking, and making sure that we are considering things like digital assets that haven't been in any codes or laws that we've had before. So this is really just making sure that we are in conformity making things a lot simpler for Minnesotans and for us to do interstate commerce as well. And with that, if I could turn it over to, I think we have Ms. Timmons, who could give a brief overview of the Uniform Law Commission, just for some members who might not be totally familiar with that.
I think that would be wonderful. If you could just come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I'm Michelle Timmons, a Uniform Law Commissioner and a former reviser of statutes for the state of Minnesota, which is how I found out when I started in 1998. I was not only the reviser, but I was a Uniform Law Commissioner. The job of ULC Commissioner came with my day job. So what is the Uniform Law Commission? It is a very old organization. It was established in 1892, and it currently has about 300 attorneys from all over the country who were appointed by each of their respective states, and they all serve without compensation. It's everybody is a volunteer. And the main objective of the organization is to draft and approve legislation that can be enacted in all 50 states. And so because of that, the organization tries to select topics where there is a need for uniformity across the states. And as Commissioner Lowe will be telling you about the Uniform Commercial Code, that is probably the crown jewel and one of the prime examples of where uniformity is needed. I wanted to tell you a little bit about the process for creating this uniform legislation. Typically, there's a study committee that studies a topic. That usually happens for about a year. And it's studied by a group of uniform law commissioners. There's a reporter who is somebody who's expert in that field. And then there are observers. Anybody who's a stakeholder who wishes to have input into the particular topic is allowed to attend the meetings. And the meetings are open to the public. Then, if the study committee says, yes, this is a great topic, there's a need for uniformity, and this is something where the states would like guidance, let's have a drafting committee. Then a committee of uniform law commissioners is appointed. Again, there's a reporter, and stakeholders are involved. That process typically takes 2 years to get something drafted. And then the annual meeting, you hear about the Uniform Law Commission annual meetings, and it's not really like any annual meeting you've been to in your life. It's more like a legislative session, because literally the drafting committee of uniform law commissioners sits up at the dais much as you are and reads the draft word for word, line by line. And then imagine this is a big room full of 300 attorneys with, you know, 4 or 6 microphones, and attorneys get up and discuss the proposal, make suggestions for amendments, and then the floor literally votes on those amendments. And through that process, the act is hopefully honed to something that can indeed be enacted in all 50 states. So then after the first reading, we wait another year, there's a second reading at the annual meeting, and then the act is hopefully approved by the full body. There is literally a vote by the states as to whether or not that act should be approved and adopted by the Uniform Law Commission. So by the time the acts get to you, they really have had a lot of thought and a lot of input from different stakeholders and points of view. So with that, I would like to turn it over back to you and Ms. Lowe.
All right. Well, I invite Kim Lowe forward. Ms. Lowe. Commissioner Lowe.
I got a couple hats on today. thank you, Chair Stevenson. My name is Kim Lowe, and I am one of the 11 commissioners in the state of Minnesota. I asked Ms. Timmons to describe the Uniform Law Commission because I'm looking around the room and some of you know what we do, but if you're not a lawyer, you don't really know what we do. So we thought it would be valuable for this committee to hear the process by which we do this. The other hat that I have on today is I'm also a lawyer, practicing lawyer here in the state of Minnesota. I'm a former chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association Business Law Committee. I'm also a person who deals every day with the Uniform Commercial Code. So I'm here in two capacities, one as a Uniform Law Commissioner and also one as an expert on, a quote-unquote expert, on the Uniform Commercial Code and the amendments that we're asking that the state adopt. One thing that's important to recognize about these amendments, and we'll take questions, we'll go through them, is that this took a long time. It started in 2019, and there were 300 observers and experts that worked on these amendments. We actually had three lawyers from the state of Minnesota, separate from the commission, who worked on these amendments. So with that, we wanted to make sure that you're aware that these are thought through, and really, as complicated as they look, they are thought through in an area that's new and emerging technology. So one thing to keep in mind, too, when we talk about the Uniform Commercial Code, and it's dry. I'll tell you it's dry because it's really what governs interstate commerce, and it's things like how do I get a bank loan? How do I buy a car? How do we sell sales? How do we sell goods between each other? One thing about the Uniform Commercial Code, we've been living under it for probably 60 or 70 years, maybe even longer. It was last amended in Minnesota in 2012, so we don't open it up very often. But in light of all of the emerging technologies that have happened since 2012, the Uniform Law Commission, the American Bar Association, the American Lawyers Institute, and other observers decided that it was time to start tackling some of these new technologies that this was not originally. They just didn't happen in 2012. So I'll go over what we've sort of tackled so you can get your arms around it a little bit. I know you didn't want to read a 132-page document. I don't blame you. But I want it in order to make Representative Kurumi to do it. We did give you some summaries, but I'll hit the highlights so you can have it in front of you in case you have some questions, and then I'll take questions about them. So the amendments themselves really are labeled for emerging technologies. And one of the key components of the amendments that are coming through are what are referred to as colloquially as digital assets. So that is the new world we live in, right? We live in a new world where things such as, or items such as cryptocurrency or non-fungible tokens exist. We've all heard about that stuff in the news. And we also live in a world where we have other electronic assets or electronic things that have been created that bankers and individuals deal with all the time. They invest in these, they have them, they may or may not have them in their investment portfolio, and other institutions have to grapple with them and how do we deal with them. So what the UCC, the new amendments to the UCC do is they create a whole new article, Article 12, and there is no Article 11. So if you read it and we're looking for Article 11, there is not one. It goes from 9 to 10 to 12, and I'm like, don't ask me where Article 11 is. So Article 12 creates this new concept called a controllable electronic record. And the concept of controllable electronic record sounds very dry, doesn't sound as sexy as Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, but really what it does is it creates this asset that exists in, it may be a blockchain, it might be something else, but it exists there, and it's, the terminology is very specific. It's a controllable digital asset. And so Article 12 creates that. The definition is actually created in Article 1. It creates a controllable digital asset, or identifies what it is, and then it creates the mechanism by which, if someone wants to pledge that as collateral for a loan, how that happens, or if it's in the in the stream of commerce, how that is dealt with. And ironically, we haven't had a lot of framework on that yet, because all of these digital assets came up and the law really hadn't been adjusted yet to figure out how to grapple with them. So that's what this new Article 12, Section 12 creates, is this whole framework for these controllable digital assets. And then we open up Article 9. I think there's, how many lawyers here? You might remember Article 9. Article 9 is dry, but we open up Article 9, which is the secure transactions section, because now we've created this asset that we have to work with on how it gets, how it becomes collateral. And so all of the amendments work through all of the commercial code as a result of creating this new, or identifying this new asset. So then the controllable digital assets are identified in Article 12, or I always say kind of corralled. And then some of the rules that we would have for other types of assets are then created, so that there's a way that if someone who has one of these assets wants to use them as collateral or otherwise deal with them in the stream of commerce, they can do that. So that's the overarch of the new technical digital assets. We also grapple with a couple items that were out there, tangible and electronic money. This does not create electronic currency or digital currency. It really grapples with the concept of now, and I don't know how many, now we have notes in the world. We have promissory notes that are electronic. We have chattel paper that is electronic. It's all living in the electronic world. And so these amendments are grappling with how we deal with that now. So it really is grappling with that technology. Not creating anything brand new. It's just helping us identify the framework for dealing with those technologies. And then it also deals, this is quite a dry, it deals with the concept of hybrid transactions, when you have a sale of good and a sale of services. Before, we used to have just goods, and services were over here. There are some transactions where they're both in together, and we needed to revise the Uniform Commercial Code to handle how we deal with both of those. And so that is not controversial. It really was just codifying what the law had come to. Then we also looked at negotiable instruments. Those are checks, or what we used to write as checks. Now we didn't have any clarity on when everyone, you know, when you go and you take the picture of your check and you deposit it, we didn't have the framework for that yet. Now we have, this creates that framework for those, what are actually negotiable instruments and how they're handled with the new technology. And then it actually just creates the, all of the amendments you see are those concepts being woven through all of the 12, but there's only 11 articles. It is a lot to read, and if anyone wants to read them, they're more than welcome to do that. And I am here to answer any questions any of you might have if you've read the overview, the summary, or the statute itself and have any questions about it. I do want to add one point. At this point, these amendments were approved by the Uniform Law Commission in the summer of 2022. In 2023, we've had 11 states adopt them, and at this point, we have 26 that actually have them in the pipeline. So after this session, we probably will be pretty close to 30 states. So we want to make sure, as Ms. Timmons talked about, the uniformity is very important. So we're not, we don't want to kick the can if we don't, because we'll get out of line with other states, and that's why it's important that we kind of move these forward at the same time.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify to this bill? Seeing none, member discussion and questions to the bill. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. What happens if we don't do this? Like, what's the, not that I don't want to do it, but it's, believe it or not, I did not know what the Uniform Law Commission was before today. So I'm interested.
Commissioner Lowe.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and Representative. So what happens if we don't do this? We are still in, or our banks and our laws are still in this sort of world of uncertainty. And so what we do when we have new technologies or new concepts is lawyers like me and other lawyers, we just try to shoehorn them into the existing laws that we have. And sometimes that's not the most effective way to solve a problem. And so a lot of times what we do is we bring the law current. We used to only, if you guys, everyone remembers, you read something, and remember how we used to communicate with facsimiles. Remember, we changed it. We used to say, you could give notice by facsimile. Well, no, we don't have faxes anymore. Who has a fax, right? So we can still use those same laws, but it's not as artful and doesn't quite solve the problems that have been created by this new technology. So if we do nothing, our state can fumble around and be out of state, out of check, but the banks and other organizations that deal with this every day really would like to see some clarity around this.
And for members who aren't familiar with the Uniform Law Commission, I think it was mentioned we have 11 commissioners in Minnesota. It's a process by which if you serve on the Uniform Law Commission for so long, you become a life commissioner. We have several very notable life commissioners from Minnesota, 11 of 300 total members. You can tell we're punching above our weight here in Minnesota on the Uniform Law Commission. Something.
Congratulations.
We're always looking for Minnesota exceptionalism, and we can feel that with the Uniform Law Commission. Representative Lieblinger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe they call that sentenced to the Uniform Law Commission. I don't know.
Well, one of our Uniform Law Commissioners sentence. Is the Speaker of the House, so I'd be careful about that.
It's a life sentence, probably. But I just wanted to say, you know, thank you for the work, your work on this, and thank you to the Uniform Law Commission on this, because, I mean, generations of law students have to learn about the Uniform Commercial Code, and, you know, I'm not deep in the weeds on this. Thank goodness I never use the thing, but I know it's important that it's there and just creates certainty. And so I just really raised my hand just to thank everyone for the work, and thank you, Representative Curran, for carrying the bill, because I don't think you're a lawyer, so you had to dig in and learn all this stuff. So thank you for doing that.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And as a non-lawyer who served on the lawyers board and tried to help get rules through and knows how difficult that process is, I also wanted to say thank you very much for sitting through and getting this work done, and I'm very appreciative of the work that you do. Thank you.
Closing comments, Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Members, please support the bill.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3868 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And House File 3868 is recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Thank you. The next file on our agenda is House File 2257 from Representative Bonner. As Representative Bonner comes forward, I will move House File 2257 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. I also will move the A5 amendment, which I believe gets the bill in the shape that Representative Bonner would like the committee to consider it. Is that accurate, Representative Bonner?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is accurate.
Any discussion to the A5? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. A5 is adopted. Representative Bonner, to your bill.
Okay, perfect. First, thank you. I always like to follow Representative Elkins, and I noticed he got some really good thoughts on managing data privacy in the state, so hopefully we will find the same experience here for kids. I'm proud to be back before you today. The Minnesota Age-Appropriate Design Code, AADC, also known as the Minnesota Kids Code, is a bill that has made many improvements from its last iteration, drawing a legal and technical expertise to better define terms, specific harms, and provide more clarity for judges and businesses alike. We listen to legal criticisms and use that feedback to inform the bill language to make it stronger, crisper, and more likely to withstand legal challenges. I've spent nearly 30 years in IT, the last 10 leading teams who build online products, so I understand what is possible. And I am uniquely qualified to lead the bill before you today. More importantly, Minnesota is uniquely positioned to be a leader here today. Let's be blunt. Many online products are designed to prioritize profit over our kids. It's wrong. It's unacceptable. And frankly, failing to act is failing is failing our kids. But the reality is we can build better, safer products by design. We can balance the interests of business and innovation with that of children, parents, and grandparents. We can do it in a way that does not allow companies to legalize their way out of meaningful change to protect kids online. We can do it in a way that does not expect parents, grandparents, and young people to become tech experts. Nor does it bury them in a myriad of settings that make it impossible to make the choices necessary to protect our kids and prevent them from becoming a commodity a product, all before reaching the age of consent. Instead, this bill creates a framework to protect kids through the highest privacy settings by default. It regulates how businesses can manage sensitive data often used to target children online. This framework sets a standard on what a company's obligations are to protect kids, but remains tech neutral on the tools and solutions they employ to do so, providing maximum flexibility and innovation to meet the needs of their customer, kids, and parents. That's just good business. We can't allow kids to access the promise of technology without all the harms that we have allowed on our watch. We all get it. This bill is about reining in abuses allowed to go on for far too long, putting our kids in harm's way. Companies know they're creating harm. Their own internal data tells them they are culpable. There are many bills out there with great intent. Some are extreme and threaten to shut down the internet between certain hours of the day, as if harmful products can't harm them in the daylight hours. Some threaten to cut kids off entirely from social media and tech, shut them out from the technology of the future, and shut them out from community and information. And frankly, they're not enforceable or reasonable. They don't move the needle, and they don't get to the root of the actual harm. I've studied many proposals to look at that look good on a campaign flyer, making bold promises, but they fail to deliver a real solution. This is the first and best bill I have found that creates real workable solutions to prevent the harm at its core. This is why I am confident it is the best bill in the country right now to keep kids safe online. This bill and this issue transcends political ideology and political parties, and unifies every legislator in this room here today. I will be blunt. I don't care about politics. I don't care about what will look good on a flyer. I care about kids. I care about doing what's right, what's possible, finding solutions, not just lip service. This bill is reasonable, logical, measured, it's practical. It uses existing best practices already used by businesses today to assess and mitigate risk, prevent harms, by making better, smarter design choices. We can build better, safer online products by design, and we can put kids above profit. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Bodnar. And before we move on to testimony on the bill, I do want to note we did hear and act upon this file last year. We are hearing it again today because of the amendment. I'm going to ask testifiers to limit their testimony to the amendment. And with that, I think our first testifier is Nicole Rocha. Is that correct?
Rocha.
Rocha. Apologies. Ms. Rocha.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. I am Nicole Rocha here today on behalf of Five Rights US, a project in cooperation between Reset Tech and the Five Rights Foundation. The current digital ecosystem did not happen by chance. It is the result of big tech's intentional choices. Notifications, endless scroll, autoplay, likes, screen refreshing. All of these are business decisions made by companies looking to maximize consumer use and attention. The result is online experiences that fixate, intentionally keeping children and teens locked into their devices. But this is not the only way. At its core, the Kids Code is simple consumer protection. As amended from last year's bill, it laser focuses in on privacy and data protection mandates, requiring that companies limit the collection and use of kids' data to what is absolutely necessary to provide the online product requested. It also requires that companies assess how their digital products use kids' personal data and to what extent these practices create risks for children. Should an assessment reveal a risk, companies must mitigate the risk by modifying data use in the design of their products. The Minnesota Kids Code was approved by this committee last year, and we've worked carefully over the interim to make it even stronger. I want to emphasize that while MetChoice has challenged a similar law in another state, that lawsuit is not complete, and Minnesota is not bound by the Northern District of California, nor by the decisions of the Ninth Circuit. I want to talk a little bit about the amendments and put them into two general buckets. One bucket would be defining amendments, clarifying amendments to ensure that businesses know exactly what they're supposed to do to comply with the law. Very carefully taken examples from tort law to define the best interests of children. And we've also tightened up the data protection impact assessment so folks know that it is truly about data management practices and not at all about what I'm going to say is the C word, which is only mentioned once in the bill, content. The only time content is mentioned in the bill is to ensure that the bill cannot be used to prevent youth from actively searching for or seeking content. So it is truly a data practices bill. The other bucket is again, that content moderation bill. If you look at the challenges around the country to any sort of law trying to protect kids online, they say it's always about content, but it's not. What we're trying to do is make sure kids are not addicted to screens and not manage what they are actually, have the companies manage what they are seeing. So those would be the two buckets of amendments, and I am happy to answer any questions about those. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Bridget Noring. Just come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Good afternoon, sir, chair, and fellow committee members. My name is Bridget Noring. I live in Hastings, Minnesota. I am the founder of the Devin J. Noring Foundation. This is my son, Devin. He is forever 19 years old after he bought a pill he thought was a Percocet that turned out to be fentanyl on Snapchat. His younger brother found him unresponsive in his room on April 4th, 2020. It was too late for us to save him. Devin died at the height of the pandemic. He had been suffering from blackout migraines and dental pain. He was under a treatment plan at the time for his cracked molar and an MRI scheduled to investigate his headaches. When those got canceled, he became increasingly desperate to relieve the pain. We found out after his death that he had gone on Snapchat with a friend and found a drug dealer known for selling teens drugs via the platform. I know now that social media platforms are a primary place where kids purchase all types of drugs, and while they may not, excuse me, and while most of them are not sold as fentanyl, many of them contain it. I had talked to Devin and his siblings about using social media safely before this tragedy, but afterward I became obsessive about it with my other two children. We had multiple conversations about talking to strangers online, and we monitored our youngest son's social media usage like a hawk. I was quickly becoming an advocate for online safety and meeting moms from across the country whose children had also died due to social media harms. I never in a million years imagined another one of my children could become a victim on the very same platform where his brother got the pill that killed him. And this reality is now our family's reality. We're not ready to talk much about that yet because our child's life and privacy are paramount, but we're right now in the midst of dealing with another violation of our family and one of our children on social media. Right now, social media companies are allowed to have a business model where our children, their most valuable users, are their most lucrative product. Their data can be sold to advertisers, and the more they interact with the platform, the more detailed and therefore valuable that data becomes. That means these companies are financially incentivized to design their products to increase engagement with features that become addictive, like nudges to engage, and use features like profiling to recommend accounts a child might like based on previous behavior. They make those recommendations even if that means connecting a child user to an adult stranger who might sell them drugs or otherwise put them in harm's way. This should not be allowed. Every other product our children touch, from the car seat my grandchildren come home from to the fireproof pajamas we dress them in at night, are required to meet specific safety requirements to be sold for use by kids, our most vulnerable population. Tech should not be an exception. That's why I'm here today to ask you to vote for the Minnesota Kids Code. It's a framework that would require these platforms to evaluate the way their product interacts with kids with an eye towards safety rather than profit. It is critical steps towards shifting the burden of keeping kids safe online from resting entirely on us parents' shoulders to that burden being shared with companies from the moment they design their products. I've lost one son to unregulated tech, and I'm fighting hard not to lose another child. I don't want another single family to experience the pain mine has. I'm a lifelong resident of Minnesota, and I'm proud that my home state has the opportunity to become a national leader in keeping kids safe online. So I implore you to please put the best interests of our kids and our families first and support the Minnesota Kids Code. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony today. I know it was very difficult for you to share your story, but it's very meaningful to the members of the committee. So thank you for that very much. Our next testifier is Shama Tolbert. Welcome to the committee. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
Hello, yes. Chairperson Stevenson, members of the committee. I had a lot wrote up, but I know we're pressed for time. I'm in support of the bill, HF 2257. I'm a concerned parent from Minneapolis, Minnesota. This bill is for children, so I would like my daughter to say what she wants to say, but I want you guys to know that by not having these securities in places for children, the algorithms are leading pedophiles and self-harm videos and reels and giving young girls complexes about themselves. A tragedy happened to us, but this is her story to tell, and we still haven't recovered from that yet. This is my daughter.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. Yeah, if you could just say your name for the record and then proceed to your testimony.
Hey, I'm Shamel Henderson speaking. Social media has made one of the biggest impacts on me and many others in the exact same way. During this time period, not realizing that social media was the root to most issues with the amount of time spent gathering anxieties, insecurities, depression, and lack of communication skills with peers, feeling left out and put down, not knowing my own worth due to these platforms. The amount of kids that feel like this make me believe that this is programming. Reality is our life is more than what the internet sees. I couldn't take down posts with my naked body at ages 12 and 13, getting exposed out to publicity, sexual harassment, and exploitation. Cyberbullying caused me so much pain, I felt suicidal, and as I had no issue communicating that to my family. This is a big deal. Social media will push more negativity than positive, showing violence, making us all bystanders to others experiencing the exact same thing and worse. Receiving messages from grown men at ages 14 and under, and mainly I didn't know these men, and I still had a chance to be abused by them and traumatized. I have realized that those pictures and videos of their genitals caused quite disturbing behavior, considering I was just a kid. Experiencing this with ages younger than well, do you think this is okay to take us children and push out us to the predators, allowing the community to have their children groomed, go missing, and run away to strangers online? For all platforms need to put this to an end, creating a safe place for teens to allow themselves to communicate and post safe content without all the disruptions of inappropriate and disgusting behavior.
Thank you very much for your testimony, for sharing your stories today. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you. And please put HF 2257 in effect. We can't speak of some things that are still in, like, police going on. And I'm sure you guys have the background on that, but it affects everybody. It doesn't just affect, you know, it affects all communities, all races, all, it goes across all lines. So we ask that you keep our kids safe. We know Minnesota is good at doing that. And we're counting on you guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next testifier is Tyler Deers. Mr. Deers.
Good
Good afternoon. As mentioned earlier, my name is Tyler Gears. I serve as the Midwest Executive Director for TechNet. I know we have spoken on this bill numerous times on the underlying statute, underlying language, so I will focus my comments on the A5 amendment. So consistent with our opposition to the underlying bill, the amendment still does not address many of the undefined definitions. For example, the amendment leaves material detriment, harmful, and potentially harmful undefined. These undefined terms are incredibly difficult to interpret. Different companies, as well as you know, parents, whoever, will have very different interpretations of what that entails, as could regulators in different states should this bill pass in Minnesota and elsewhere. Regarding the DPIAs, the assessment language makes changes to the data protection impact assessment, which is also known as DPIAs. Businesses under this would be required to assess 8 different factors related to harm prior to offering any service or feature. These reports would then have to be reviewed and made available to the Attorney General upon request. Furthermore, businesses would have to assess the risks associated with the new feature or service, and it would lead to material harmful or potentially harmful to a child. This would certainly delay a company's ability to implement a new service or feature, such as a moderation policy or a new feature to communicate with folks on the internet. This is also a complex data assessment that is different from the version. I know that's in Representative Elkins' bill. We just talked about that. I know his bill has a similar provision and would be onerous on businesses to comply with both simultaneously. Further, we have worked, I know, with Representative Elkins over months on that bill and believe that the data protections for adults and children contained in that bill will address many of the concerns that are raised by the bill's proponents. And lastly, the amendment adds fiduciary language to the bill and would require businesses to prioritize the best interests of children above all else. For example, if a conflict arises between, say, commercial interests and the best interests of a child, companies would have to prioritize the privacy, safety, and well-being of children over those interests. Typically speaking, fiduciary obligations typically are imposed on a one-on-one circumstance, for example, like a lawyer representing a client. This would impose fiduciary obligations to millions of individuals at once. I know the amendment does seek to bracket the age appropriateness, but as we know, a 15-year-old may be more mature than a 17-year-old. Effectively, if businesses owe fiduciary obligations to a diverse populations with conflicting needs, it would make it impossible to serve that population at all. So in closing, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to testify and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gears. Next, we have Aaron Walsh. Let's come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Aaron Walsh, and I'm the co-founder of Spark and Stitch Institute here in Minnesota. And I have been working with children, youth, families, educators, and mental health professionals for about 20 years in this state. And our mission has always been to maximize the benefits and minimize the harms of media's impact on child and adolescent health and development. And the widespread use of technology obviously has increased critical concerns about its impact on mental health, on child development, and on safety. And I think everyone in this room knows that we are in the middle of an epidemic of anxiety, depression, and loneliness. And I want to be clear that the reality is that the relationship between social media use and mental health outcomes for any individual child or adolescent is indeed complicated. Yet tech executives and lobbyists always citing this sort of idea of inconclusive evidence is an insidious dodge of responsibility at this point, because it actually distracts us from the question that's in front of us today as Minnesotans. We know that you can ensure that websites and apps are safer for kids by design. We have all the evidence we need to make this choice. Research is clear that manipulative design features are at odds with the developmental needs of kids. Current design, as we've heard from other testimonies, encourages compulsive behavior. It captures private data, allows unknown users to contact children and youth, and the data that companies collect on children drive algorithms that put kids directly in harm's way. I, as I talk with families across the state, know that they are tired. They are tired because we have placed the entire burden of protection on them. This isn't just unfair, though. It actually exacerbates this sort of unequal distribution of risk across our communities and across our state. When we think about child and adolescent development, we know that kids are not just little adults or mini adults. They actually have unique strengths and vulnerabilities and sensitivities. Indeed, that's why neuroscientists often talk about adolescence and childhood as both a window of opportunity and a window of sensitivity. It's time for tech companies to understand that they can no longer ignore the specific needs of their youngest users. As both a parent and a resident and a professional in the state, I think that we are in a window of opportunity as well. That's why I support the amendment to House File 2257. This content neutral and design focused bill gets upstream from online harms and allows us to fulfill that mission that I've been working on my entire career, which is to maximize the benefits and allow children and youth access to the important things that they can find online while minimizing harms. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Amy Bowes. Let's come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Amy Boss. I'm the Director of State and Federal Affairs at NetChoice, a trade association of leading internet businesses. We share the sponsor's goal to better protect minors from harmful content online and appreciate the efforts to try and address constitutional concerns. While well-intentioned, the proposed amendment remains fundamentally flawed from a legal perspective and a policy perspective. An unconstitutional law protects no one, including kids. The proposed amendment is similar to California's age-appropriate design code legislation passed in California in 2022. In September, the United States District Court for the Northern District of California granted NetChoice's motion for a preliminary injunction enjoining the enforcement of the legislation. The court, after reviewing 10 of the Act's provisions, held that all 10 likely violated the First Amendment. Similar legislation is also on hold in Ohio and in Arkansas. Minnesota's AADC is similarly likely to run afoul of the First Amendment due to its strong inducement for online platforms to over-censor content in order to avoid being penalized under the law's vague concept of best interest of the child. Under threat of fines for misjudging what may be considered potentially harmful to children, many platforms will certainly default to taking down all content on entire subjects, which is likely to remove beneficial, constitutionally protected material along with anything genuinely harmful. Additionally, while the amendment does not explicitly require age verification to achieve compliance and avoid the proposed penalties for violation, it is likely the amendment's profiling or age estimation requirements would effectively amount to age verification. This requires children and adults alike to share with virtually every website visited personal information like identification documents or face scans that should they fall into the wrong hands, could possibly use for identity theft or other nefarious purposes. And this is not just large operators, but any website that is reasonably to be accessed by a 17-year-old, including Best Buy, Target, or other beloved Minnesota businesses. In conclusion, the proposed amendment is well-intended, but remains constitutionally flawed. The law is simply too vague for even the most conscientious online service to be able to comply with. Thus, we ask that legislators oppose the legislation from moving forward. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name.
No worries.
Next, we have Eric Mischke. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Eric Mischke. I'm the Executive Director of SAVE, Suicide Awareness Voices of Education. SAVE celebrates its 35th anniversary this August. An anniversary that reminds us that despite our best efforts to save lives by preventing suicide, our work is clearly not done. Suicide is complex. There is no single reason why, and there is no single way to prevent suicide. However, the Minnesota's Kids' Choice is one of those solutions to suicide prevention that we are proud to support along with today's proposed amendment. Before 2008, the suicide rate for young people was declining. And then in 2008 through 2018, the suicide rate among 13 and 14-year-olds more than doubled, making it the leading cause of death for 13 and 14-year-olds. From 2006 through 2015, social media platforms that our kids use today became public. Coincidence? Or where there's smoke, there's fire. In April 1994, the CEOs of Big Tobacco CEOs testified on Capitol Hill and under oath stated that the addictive nature of nicotine from their products did not exist. In January 2024, the CEOs of Big Tech testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee and denied that there's enough evidence that social media platforms are linked to increases in mental illness or suicidal ideation. Today's Big Tobacco is Big Tech, and the big lie is that there is no proof between social media harming our children's mental health and increases in social or in suicidal ideation. It's time we stop listening to Big Tech and their lobbyists who promise us their products are safe and start listening to parents who know that they're not. It is a false choice between giving kids access to social media or protecting their mental health and reducing suicidal ideation. The fact is, we can do both, and this bill does just that. Industry-funded schemes and promises to remove harmful content or content rating systems are little more than public relations gimmicks. The Minnesota Kids Code isn't the only solution to prevent youth suicide and save lives, but it's an important and proven one that we believe deserves your vote. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm really on a roll today with name mispronouncing.
That's all right. I've been called worse. Trust me.
Next testifier is Jeff Tollefson. I think I got that one right.
You did, Chairman Stevenson. Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Tollefson. I serve as the president of the Minnesota Technology Association. We're a coalition of about 200 technology-enabled companies really trying to build a stronger and more inclusive tech ecosystem in Minnesota. First, I want to say we applaud your efforts to protect Minnesota's children. And the safety and best interests of our children should indeed come ahead of business interests of companies that are operating here. So you'll have no objection from us in this regard. I also want to thank committee members for really tapping the brakes last session and spending some time on improving on the language, and really want to give you kudos for doing that. My primary concern is the impact this legislation will have on Minnesota businesses that are not, quote, big tech, social media platforms to which this bill is seemingly directed. The broad reach includes websites that are, quote, reasonably likely to be accessed by children under the age of 18. We believe this is an overly inclusive standard that will subject lots of websites and platforms to the bill's requirements. Our websites hosted by Minnesota companies like Best Buy, Target, or even Polaris, reasonably likely to be accessed by children under the age of 18? Absolutely, as they go looking for clothing, look at the next generation of recreational vehicles. The business subject to this broad and fairly subjective definition are required to complete a data protection impact assessment for every online service, product, and feature that kids under the age of 18 are reasonably likely to access. These assessments would be costly, time-consuming for those websites and features that have a low risk of negatively impacting children. If the intended targets of this legislation are social media platforms, can we then craft a definition that better addresses these companies and platforms? Minnesota is filled with lots of well-intended, socially responsible companies, and we urge you not to impose additional regulatory requirements on a broad range of companies that are not in any way harming our children. Thank you again for undertaking this important work, and we really urge you to think more closely around the inclusivity of some of these definitions. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Our last testifier is Jeffrey Kluge. Hoping I got... I apologize.
Thank you. It's Jeff Kluge. I'm CEO and founder of Holistic Ethics, a Minnesota-based LLC, and also creator of Kids Tech Ethics. I'm here to support HF 2257 and supplement my written testimony with today's verbal notes as well. I want to come up here and explain that this law, the amendments that have been done, are heralded, should be heralded, in terms of the DPIA and walking through some of the obligations that are available, the information fiduciary. During the last 3 years, I have also been a fellow at For Humanity, a nonprofit institution that is at the forefront of building trust and accountability through AI audits of systems that interact with humans around the world. It's through this experience that I want to bring a couple of points to you today on these amendments and the benefits with them. Opponents have claimed that there is a harm to Minnesota through this, but the true detriment to Minnesota is losing our trained technology talent to companies with monopolistic powers elsewhere. We just heard that social media companies outside the state, they have an enormous benefit that good companies here in Minnesota uphold and stand by. We can't compete in that regard. Kids Code helps to balance that playing field, and I think it does a very nice job through requirements that you've made in these amendments. I heard today that opponents of the bill say that this is too hard, that it's complicated. Ladies and gentlemen, they operate the most sophisticated algorithms and computer technologies that humankind has ever seen, processing data faster than we can think, and they're doing that in front of children. A child inadvertently hops onto a website or follows something that one of their friends say, and they're hooked. They're clicked into, oh, you clicked on that. You may want to know more about this. And it's a cycle that can't be broken, and you have today the ability to stand up and help rectify this. The last point that I would like to make is that tech has claimed that they have all the solutions. And unfortunately, we wouldn't be here today if they had the self-regulation and the discipline to do this on their own. Unfortunately, they've proven time and time again through testimony to the AGs, one of the largest social media companies, internal documents are coming forth that they knew what was happening, and yet they proceeded anyways. I highly support this bill, Kids Code. Look forward to seeing it pass through this legislative session. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ruth Whitaker, and I serve as the Director of Civic Innovation Policy for Chamber of Progress, a tech industry coalition committed to ensuring that all Americans benefit from technological leaps. We urge your committee to oppose HF 2257, which will impose fundamental changes to how critical online services work. One of Chamber of Progress's top priorities is ensuring that children have access to safe and inclusive online spaces. While we appreciate the sponsor's willingness to work on the bill, our concerns remain that the age-appropriate design code may end up doing more harm than good by exacerbating the vulnerabilities of marginalized young people. The CDC's latest Adolescent Behaviors and Experiences survey revealed that more than half of young people experienced emotional abuse in the home, and more than 10% reported experiencing physical abuse in the home. A majority of adolescents reported that social media helps them feel more accepted. The support social media offers from peers to mitigate stress can be especially important for youth who are often marginalized, including racial, ethnic, and sexual and gender minorities. For example, minors within the LGBTQ plus community use social media to find friends, seek emotional support, and search for information about their identities and health, especially those growing up in unsupportive families or communities. There may be unintended consequences concerning the definitions of harm and best interest to minors, including over-moderation. We're concerned that HF 2257 lacks clear and specific definitions, and fearful that the Attorney General may deem certain content harmful to some or all minors, or find a company's newly required child-centric data protection assessments inadequate. Online services will be pressured to identify remote or unlikely harms and to self-censor accordingly.
The AADC will thus discourage websites from hosting and promoting content for users under the age of 18 and for adults due to age assurance challenges, including critical resources that underprivileged children rely on to deal with familial and personal crises. We agree with the need to build in greater protections for young users, but some of the bill's requirements would end up harming vulnerable users. Accordingly, we request that you oppose HF 2257 as amended. Thank you.
Member discussion and questions to the bill. Seeing none, Representative Representative Kizwatoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to again express my gratitude, Representative Bonner, for your leadership in this issue. I know it's something that you care deeply about, and I think, you know, it's pretty well known that Steve Jobs didn't allow his children to use a lot of the technological devices that he designed with his colleagues at Apple. But I don't see how, for many of us as parents, that's still an option when now our children are being provided devices in order to learn in school and expected to bring them home for snow day learning, et cetera, et cetera. This is something that we're dealing with our fourth grader, third grader, and second grader on a very regular basis in my family. And so I think putting something into place like this that really allows companies to think through the processes and the features and how they might impact developing minds, I think, is really critical. And I think that some of the things that the last testifier just shared, I think, are even more important. And I don't think that, you know, could be considered harmful. We want children to be able to have access to those networks. We want them to be able to do it safely. And so I think with regard to what you had said initially in terms of it being a content neutral proposal, I think that really makes a lot of sense. And I just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonner, thank you for your leadership on this. You know, in listening to some of the comments from the tech industry, they would sit with me a lot and stronger if you had actually addressed this issue up to now, but it continues to seeming to get worse. I heard that one of the arguments was social media is saving kids. And another one, maybe not your best argument, that horror of horrors, this could wind up prioritizing the best interests of kids over profits. I really appreciate the work on this, and thank you for your leadership.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Bonner. Contrary to some of the testimony, I actually am in no way concerned about how difficult it would be for businesses to implement this. That is, frankly, the least of my concerns. I with this issue particularly, I'm fine with that burden. I am, however, very concerned about passing a bill that can withstand scrutiny, that is clearly defined, and is even able to be implemented. And I am still very concerned that what we've got here is a bill presented that is really complicated in ways that it just doesn't need to be. I go back to Representative Robbins' bill that we heard. It's very simple. Social media companies can't use algorithms to push content. They get the content they subscribe to. That's it. They can't push it. This seems to be getting at a similar thing in a just a super complicated way that still has big question marks. So I would ask, in the amendment, you've tried to define things. However, I mean, I look at age appropriate right on the first page of the amendment, and it talks about these different age ranges that need to be taken into account. There's five different age ranges. So what does it mean to take into account
these developmental, and I'll be honest, this is actually my degree is in family science and child development. And these five stages were new to me. Like, I've never seen them laid out this way even. Like, this isn't a standard definition of developmental stages. And taking into account a child at 0 to 5 is wildly different than taking into account developmental stages at 16 or 17. So what does that even mean? What does it mean to take into account those stages? How does that work in practice?
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I will start with, first, you know, some of the definitions that we put in around age appropriate were actually the result of, ironically, folks in the industry actually asking us to define the term better. So the reason that is there is at their request, candidly. So I think that's really important to call out here. And I think when we talk about how do we design products that are safe for the potential user, you know, what's really interesting is we're talking about this in a very different sense, but when we talk about building a piece of software or a feature or a piece of functionality, there's a huge conversation in today about what's called UX and CX, right? But UX basically refers to user design. In other words, how do you know your user? How do you understand what they need and what they want and what is most useful for them? And so part of that is being able to speak to those developmental ages, of course. And what's interesting is that for the most part, I think one of our testifiers said it earlier, when we talk about tech, we really don't actually think about kids when we design these products. We rarely do, even when we know that they are some of the largest users of the of this particular technology, and yet we don't do it, right? So I guess I would say that having the ability to focus in on the needs of users based on their specific developmental ages can be extremely helpful, useful, and frankly, it's just a good business practice to know your user from that perspective. But as for the deeper dive on where those definitions came from, I actually have my testifier here who I think can give you a little bit deeper dive on how those were derived.
So those particular age ranges come from the age-appropriate design code and what we've seen happen in the UK. So they were developed with the Information Commissioner's Office, who is the enforcer of the law over there. And I think just anecdotally, and not to pick on one particular company, but why those ages are set up like that. So this is my youngest. I did not bring her as a prop, but she happens to be here with me. You know, people have their young children watching YouTube as well as their teens. And so if you are a platform like YouTube that is for a general audience, in your impact assessment, the bill would ask that you look at how your product affects kids of different ages. And those ages were put in there at the exact response of tech, like you said, to say you can't treat a 2-year-old the same as you treat a 16-year-old. So trying to create some age ranges. And if I could also just speak to some of the definitions. Defining best interests of the child, so that was not defined last year. It was kind of a conceptual term. It is now very clearly defined based on tort law. So it is severe emotional distress, which has, you know, been recognized for decades within our court. And I know this is going to judiciary next, but it's financial harm, severe emotional distress, material physical harm. These are all things that have been recognized in tort law. And importantly, I think, in response to the testimony from Chamber of Progress, there's also anti-discrimination language in there. So you can't knowingly use your product. That's going to result in discrimination against children in protected places.
Representative Brindley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure we understand still what it means to take into account. I mean, does that mean that websites or services would need, I mean, there's five different age categories. Would they need five different versions of what they do? What does that mean? Because again, 1-year-old is let's say 2 years old, because one is a little young, but a 2-year-old literally nowadays is on YouTube by themselves. Like, it's bonkers.
Yeah.
But that's still very, very different than a 17-year-old. So are we talking five different versions? What does it mean to take that into account in practical terms? That's what I'm concerned about. I want this to happen. I want our kids to be safe. I just think this is still so vague, and it doesn't get us there. I feel like we've taken this UK thing and plopped it in here in a way that it's still not going to work. And we're just told that, I mean, these definitions even came from the UK. They don't come from the NIH. They don't come from the CDC. They don't come from accepted practice in the United States. Like, it's just, that is extraordinarily frustrating to me. I would also just ask, you know, I mean, this data protection assessment, looking at that, again, I could care less about how difficult that is for a business to complete or maintain. I don't care. I do have concern, however, that, I mean, the Attorney General made it very clear. Like, I mean, this is what he said. Given the uncertain impact of requiring companies to self-report and the required administrative effort to process such a report, we suggest the state of Minnesota plainly direct the design requirements of companies within legislation. And we're not doing that. We're still telling them to do this. I'm not sure why. I know you're all surprised to hear me say, why aren't we listening to the AG? But in this case, he's asking for more clarity, and we're not giving it. And we should be. I think that is problematic. And again, you know, I mean, on page four, the impact assessment, it says that, you know, these things need to be designed and offered in an age-appropriate manner consistent with the best interest of the child. Again, I don't know what that means. Is that five versions for these five different age groups? I just think we are still trying to take a very simple concept. I mean, again, we could just say no algorithms. You can't push content. We can't control content. We know that. But we haven't solved a single problem with this amendment, and it's just extraordinarily frustrating. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonner.
I'll say a couple things. There's a lot to unpack there, but I'll try to do it quickly because I know we have another bill to get to. First, whether or not this is a workable solution and it can work, just to be really 100% crystal clear, it is, has been implemented across the pond, and it is working. Some of the changes we have seen tech make already to their products are already in play, right? In fact, there is some folks who've done some research and can tell you that there is a very different experience for kids across the pond who are accessing online products than there is in the U.S. Very, very different. Secondly, in terms of age appropriate, the easy answer for that is it depends. That's why you do a data privacy impact assessment. You assess where your risks are, what is the level of that risk, and what needs to be mitigated before you put that into your design plan. And so it depends. If your product is designed for, you know, young children, then you should be addressing that and looking at those and prioritizing those potential harms. If your product is not aimed at those folks, but it is aimed at higher age groups, you can modify your assessment and your level of risk and what you need to do to mitigate that risk based on the appropriateness of that audience. I mean, I think that's actually pretty simple. And by the way, companies do it all the time. And, you know, as for the data impact assessment, I will just say it is really easy. Companies are already doing it. They do it today. They do it all the time. Most of the companies we're talking about here probably already do it. The question is whether or not they do it through the lens of child safety. And the quick answer there, at least on this side of the pond, is they do not.
Okay, so we have about 2 minutes left in our committee time. We can go just a little bit over. We have two members on the list. We're going to do that. We're probably going to hold Representative O'Driscoll's bill to Monday. I did want to ask, are there any members of the public here to testify? Is there anyone here to testify as to Representative O'Driscoll's bill? Okay, I'm not seeing anyone. So we're going to finish off the list. We're going to move this bill, and then we'll do Representative O'Driscoll's bill on Monday, since there's no one from the public here. Representative Cha.
I'll keep my remarks short. Thank you, Bonner, for bringing this bill forward. As a former computer programmer, I understand what we are facing. You know, with generative AI and machine learning and the quantum computers that are coming out, we have the technology to solve this simple problem. I've written algorithms in my past. I know we have very smart, capable people who can write algorithms to protect our children. Yes. And so it's not a problem that we can't solve. And so thank you for bringing this bill forward. And I think we're behind this game. And so we need to catch up. Thank you.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Bonner, for taking on this issue, genuinely. It's an issue that we need to take on. I'm hearing mixed messages about whether this is really a Minnesota-tailored solution or whether this is, you know, copying the British model or the California model that has been struck down. And I read the opinion from the Northern District of California. I read the U.S. Supreme Court case, the Sorrell case. I think we really have to seriously grapple with how we navigate that landscape. And I'm just really concerned that this isn't quite there yet. I'm going to raise a couple of general big picture problems, I think, with implementation, and then I have one specific question. The first problem with implementation, I think, is the best interest of the child standard makes a lot of sense when you're talking about a specific child. It makes a lot less sense when you're talking about and using the word fiduciary to refer to all of the children in the state of Minnesota. I think that's a pretty fundamental problem with the whole framework of this bill. I'm concerned about the way that the prohibitions on what a business can do when it deals with children, with the restrictions on what a business can do in terms of estimating a child's age. A business, first of all, isn't really allowed to figure out whether they're dealing with the child, and then flatly prohibited from doing certain things in relation to a child. I'm not sure how those pieces of the bill actually fit together. But the most concerning thing I have about the bill, and I would like you to, we're going to judiciary next, so we'll continue this conversation there, but I want to specifically ask you in relation to line 7.11 to 7.13 of the amendment, if we're primarily concerned with protecting children online, why are we separating the child from the oversight of their parents in the ability to, if the amendment prohibits a company from, quote, allowing a child's parent, guardian, or any other consumer to monitor the child's online activity or track the child's location without providing an obvious signal to the child when the child is being monitored or tracked. To be totally transparent, I monitor my children's online activity and I track their location. I think it's pretty clear to them that they know that. But why are we separating the parent from the child in that way in this bill?
And Representative Bonner, if you can answer that relatively briefly, and understand that maybe you can have a continuing conversation offline, but if you can answer briefly that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I'm going to punt that one over to my friend here because I think she's got a good answer for you.
Ms. Rocha.
Yes, thank you. That was actually in the bill that the committee approved last year. It's just been moved to a new section, so it appears as though it's new, but I can also tell you why it's there. So if we are looking at the rights of children and the rights of parents and taking them together, that line does not say that parents cannot track their children. It just says that they can't secretly track their children. And so for those of you who have an iPhone, I think, you know, you see the little orange dot that shows up when the microphone's on, or the little green dot that shows up when the camera is on. It's sort of like that. If you are being tracked, then if the child is being tracked, then they need to have an obvious signal when they are being tracked, and it just can't be done secretly. And that is a way of trying to respect the rights of both children and parents simultaneously.
All right. We're going to leave the conversation there. The bill is going to another committee, and we've had a full discussion over a couple years now of this bill. So given that we're over time, we're also going to forego closing comments. I will renew my motion that House File 2257, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 2257, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. And our agenda being complete for today, the meeting is adjourned.